Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, there she's back.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello, everyone. I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters podcast. Welcome aboard. I'd like to warn everyone in advance, I have been told our system is acting a little bit wonky. So if we start experiencing some technical difficulties during the show, don't panic. Leave that to me. I'll be over here panicking. But right now, we're going to be having for discussion today the topic of abortion. And to help me with that, I've got Megan Allman of the Life Training Institute on the line. Megan, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Before we start talking about the topic, first off, tell us a little bit about yourself, I mean, how you came to be where you're at today, and then the question I also like to ask, since people might not know who guests are, is why should my audience be taking your opinion on these matters seriously?
Gotcha. I graduated from the University of Georgia in 2004 with a degree in journalism and went to work just after that at a newspaper in Newnan, Georgia, where my husband is from. And one night, there was a crisis pregnancy center banquet in our community. So being the community newspaper, I was sent to cover that banquet. And I heard the man who is now my boss, that's Life Training Institute's president, Scott Busendorf, speak that night. I was so blown away with the case that he presented. I had never really heard Christian apologetics in that way before or presented before, and particularly dealing with the pro-life view. I went home and immediately started reading everything I could get my hands on. Over the course of the next year and a half or so, I became increasingly just, I had a great desire to do the kind of work Scott was doing. So I left my job with the support of my husband and went back to school, and I earned a Master of Arts degree in Christian Apologetics from Biola University. I just finished that up in 2011.
Congrats.
I've been working with LTI since 2009. Scott will tell you that I bugged him to death until he hired me. I don't think that's really true. I was persistent, but I'm very happy to be working with him now, and honestly, as far as listening to me, I hope people will take what I do seriously. I think about this issue 24/7. This is what I talk about, what I write about, what I travel around the country training students to talk about and to think about well. It helps to have that broader understanding of the Christian worldview to undergird what we do at LTI, because we certainly are a Christian organization. But this is what I do. It's my thing.
Now, let me ask you a few questions about what you just told me. Before you heard Scott speak, were you a Christian?
I was a Christian, yes.
Okay. And what was your what was your stance on abortion?
At that point, I would have called myself pro-life, but I would not have been able to defend that position had someone challenged me, even in the most benign way.
Okay, well, you'd said that Scott's talk kind of blew you out of your water. Now, tell us some about the Life Training Institute, then, exactly. What is the Life Training Institute?
Sure. The Life Training Institute is a pro-life apologetics organization. We are a training organization. So what we seek to do is to travel around the country, like I said, and we work with students, primarily students in Christian high schools, on college campuses, but I would say students of all ages, because we certainly train many adult audiences as well, to defend their pro-life views. So we want them to be able to make a persuasive case for life and to make a stand for those views in the marketplace of ideas. And we do that by teaching them to appeal to things like science and to philosophy, whereas oftentimes you'll hear, well, the Bible says that we should have Thanksgiving life. Well, certainly we agree with that, but not everyone out there is ready to hear that. So we teach them to make a persuasive case using other means.
Yeah, I think this is an important point for us to mention. You've said Life Training Institute is a Christian organization, and it certainly is. But these arguments you're giving, they do not depend on Christianity at all. It could be the case that Islam is true or atheism is true, and these arguments could still hold.
Right. Well, being a Christian, I believe the Christian worldview is absolutely true. So I would say that everything that we argue is grounded there, but Because the arguments are scientific, philosophic in nature, people of any worldview can be helped to see the truth and the validity of them.
Okay. Now, you've said that this is the issue that gets you passionate. So before we start really talking about the issue, I would ask one thing that whenever we're describing something that happens, there could be times that you might have to get a little bit graphic and such, so just give us some sort of warning in advance, because I can tell you I'm with you in pro-life, but I've never even seen the silent scream sometimes, because I know I'd probably just throw up if I had to watch something like that taking place. And I'm sure I'm not the only one. Just like, actually, my wife has to get all the way through it even, and she can handle a lot more stuff than I can. By the way, I can even look at a paper cup without feeling nauseous. So we're trying to keep that in mind, so that if we get something that the listeners might need to prepare themselves for, let's just say that. All right?
Right. Fair warning. I gotcha.
Okay. Now, you said this issue got you passionate. Why? What is the issue, and why does it really matter?
Well, it's a great question. When I speak to students, there are two questions that I address with them. And I believe that those two questions are the ones that our culture and even our world right now are in a huge battle over. The first one, of course, is dealing with the nature of truth itself. Is truth, and when I say that, particularly moral truth, is it something that is real and knowable? Can we talk about it that way, or is it something we just decide for ourselves? And so we live in a culture that typically thinks truth is subjective in nature. It would be no different than choosing one flavor of ice cream over another. So when it comes to this issue, that is the case. People think, well, I see that you are pro-life. That's great for you. I think differently. So we run into that a lot. On the flip side of that, there's also the question, why are human beings valuable? That's what really hit my tuning fork. I am fascinated with reading about human value. Why are we valuable? What is it that gives us rights that other people are obligated to respect? And as a Christian, the real question is, we have this beautiful gospel message that was meant to be spread to the world, but how in the world do we spread that message to a world that's forgotten what it means to be human? So those things, when I start thinking and talking about those things, it really hits home, and I think it's that important.
Okay. Well, I had someone post on my Facebook day saying that this was an anniversary of abortion when they had it legalized, and about how many people have been murdered through abortion. Now, the abortion became the law of the land back in 1973, Roe v. Wade, right?
That's right.
Okay. What are the statistics, then? How many babies have we lost since then to abortion?
Oh, wow. Well, the numbers run up well over 50 million, Nick. It's a massive number. I usually run with conservative estimates when I try to give numbers. In the United States today, a conservative estimate of the number of abortions performed daily are about 3,500 every business day in the U.S. alone. It's an astronomical amount.
I remember riding on this back in January, and there have been more abortions by now than there are if you took the population of the state of California almost 1.5 times over.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. And about 3,500 say that not talking here around will be losing their lives.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The numbers are huge. And Nick, I'm sorry, you're kind of cutting in and out just a little bit.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Our station's acting a bit wonky today.
It's all right. It's all right.
So, how exactly do you think we got to this point?
How did we get to this point? Well, I think that ideas can have devastating consequences. Certainly when the law passed, when Roe v. Wade was passed in 1973 and its sister case, Doe versus Bolton, when those came down, it kind of opened the door. So suddenly, you know, the state was okay with this thing with abortions. Now, if you go and look at the laws, there are some interesting things about them and how they came to be and whatnot. But beside that point, when that happened, of course, the floodgates kind of opened. And so here, you know, today, what you'll hear a lot of times is, well, the state says that abortion is okay, so it must be all right. So there's that idea out there. The language that is used, and it has been used increasingly since that point in time, and even prior to that, as what termed women's rights. I think oftentimes that disguised, people talk about abortion that way. Well, it's women's rights. As those conversations were being had, just the different phrases that you'll hear, it's just a clump of tissue, or it's not human, it's not alive, it's not a person yet. Any number of those things, those ideas, will have the consequences to where people will think, well, this is nothing. It's no different than clipping a fingernail or pulling a tooth. Now, I would certainly say that the case we make says otherwise. But those ideas are so convoluted out there that I think that's the major problem. And of course, then again, we live in a culture of gratification, instant gratification, and that also runs in the mix.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about this Bolton case. I actually haven't heard about that before. You said it was a sister case of Roe v. Wade. What happened in this case?
Well, in Doe versus Bolton, the big thing that's important for what we're talking about is that the court took the definition of health, because in Roe versus Wade, the legislation basically said that if a state chooses to pass legislation protecting the unborn, it cannot interfere with a woman's health. And so in the Doe case, the court went back, and what they did was they defined health so very broadly that you could drive a train through it. It was. So, accordingly, you know, health is defined as in light of all the factors, Nick, physical factors, emotional factors, psychological factors, familial factors, the woman's age, anything that's relevant to the, quote, well-being of the patient. You could imagine that people will take those and run with them. And that's the damage that came with the Doe case.
Now, you said that this is also because we live in a culture that wants instant gratification. This was around the same time then of the sexual revolution, wasn't it?
Several of those things, historically, yes. They kind of ran pretty close together, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So part of it could have been where we want to be able to have all the sex we want and be able to not have any consequences. And if we have this nasty consequence of a baby that we don't want, we have to be able to deal with it.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that is a very, very relevant point. And on the heels of the 60s, as 1973 was, probably contributed a great deal.
Yeah. And what I kind of wonder about that time of 1973 and such is, what exactly was the church doing then? Because it seems like we fell asleep at the wheel big time.
Well, that's a great question. You know, so I didn't come into the picture until 1982, but just even as it is now, I don't know if during that time it was more or less obvious in a way that the church held on to the history of thinking, well, this is something that's morally wrong, so we're not going to be involved with that. Now, when it became legal, I don't know exactly what the church did as far as retaliation or even just to counter those ideas. But even now, what we see increasingly in the church, because moral relativism has really permeated the church's walls all over the place, what we see now is this idea more and more, well, I am personally pro-life. But who am I to say that someone else can't make that decision if according to their circumstances or according to their belief system? Just as we see within Christianity in general, well, I'm a Christian, but who am I to say that someone else can't believe this or that? I think that's probably the primary problem.
And
one of them. There are so many we could name. But
yeah, and it ties in today also about age. Everyone's supposed to be tolerant and non-judgmental and such.
Well, tolerant in what sense? That's the question. There was a time when tolerance meant that you showed respect to an individual even though you disagreed with their ideas. Now intolerance means that when you can't agree with someone, then you don't tolerate the person. It's just a strange twisting on the definition of tolerance, or on the traditional definition of it, and that is, that card is pulled many times in my own work, and as you know, anyone who works in apologetics can kind of tell, who studies it or has an interest.
I find usually that the people that want to preach the gospel of tolerance the most tend to practice it the least, that this tolerance really is a one-way street. Have you found that too?
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I get it a lot of times and in different forms. You are intolerant, of course, that's the direct, or you shouldn't push your morality on other people this way. You're so judgmental. It comes out in many different ways. But the idea is always the same, because the very thing that an individual is, of course, as you probably know, Nick, the very thing an individual is accusing you of doing, they are doing to you. To say that you shouldn't push your morality on other people, well, a simple question, why not? Or what do you mean when you say I shouldn't push my morality on other people? Their statement, as soon as they say the word should or ought or anything of that nature, is a moral type of statement. And so they are doing the very thing they're accusing me of doing.
We had Greg Kokor come on here last month, and I'm sure you know he used to be Scott Klusendorf's boss. And
yes.
He would say that statement also commits the suicide fallacy, because the person who says you shouldn't push your morality on other people is pushing the morality, but you shouldn't push morality onto you.
Exactly. Greg is what a great guy. He's one of my apologetics heroes. And yes, he and Scott both. His tactic material, as a matter of fact, is one of the things, as soon as I heard Scott speak for the first time, I dug right into that, because Scott was still very affiliated with Stand to Reason, which is Craig's organization, when I heard him speak.
And in case you're curious, when Greg was on here, he's been an hour with us, and he was talking about tactics. So I'm sure that as kind of like a preliminary to the information you're going to give us about abortion, that you would recommend that people just learn to reason through things like tactics and such.
Yes. Greg's material first of all, it's very accessible. Secondly, what it does is it teaches you the importance of asking good questions. And of drawing people out through through the asking of good questions, which I think is an example of Christ himself. He asks questions all the time. And you know, Greg's a really gracious guy, and so he definitely lives what he preaches as far as that goes. But just a really wonderful way and a wonderful resource to be able to begin doing apologetics. And the thing you'll find about it is you'll start asking yourself the same questions. So it makes you a little sharper, too, in your own belief system.
Mm-hmm. Our call-in number right now is 714-242-5180. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast with our guest, Megan Allman of the Life Training Institute, Talk About Abortion. We are going to take a brief break, and we will be back to continue discussing abortion.
Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grock as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told, every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out cyiworldwide.com.
This is Mike Lacona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
And we are back, and I fairly thank Mike for that promo that he was kind enough to provide for us. And we are talking with Megan Allman of the Life Training Institute. Our number is 714-242-5180. If you have a question about abortion, feel free to call in. If you have an argument, feel free to call in. Or even I'd say, if you want to give a testimony about abortion, maybe you've had one, you'd like to tell us how your opinion might be right now, or maybe you've helped someone stop it, or maybe you didn't help someone stop anything related to abortion, give us a call, 714-242-5180. Okay, so we are wanting to make the pro-life case, again, so in good basic terms, you're wanting to make it accessible to people, laymen. I know there can be a lot of deep science behind these kinds of things, and if someone knows the science, that's great, but if you're wanting to give a layman's case for abortion that anyone off the street could make, give us the case.
Great.
The case for life.
The case for life, yes. Yep. And you can do that. What you have to do when that happens are three basic things. Number one, you have to learn how to simplify the issue when you are talking about abortion with someone else. And to do that, you've got to bring the issue back to one question. Because there is one question that the entire debate hinges upon, and that question is, what is the unborn? You have to answer that question before we can even talk about whether or not we can kill the unborn. That is the one we have to bring it back to. And oftentimes what people will do is skip right over that question, and they will give you reasons for why abortion should be okay, for why it should be legal. When they do that, you should ask yourself, would this be all right if we were talking about a toddler? If we were talking about a toddler, because if a toddler, we know a toddler is human, and if the unborn is human like that toddler, then there's no essential difference between the two that would make it okay to kill the unborn. So Scott actually, along with Greg and some others, developed a technique called trot out the toddler. And to do that, when the next time someone gives you a justification for why abortion should be all right, let's take, we can take privacy, for example. Privacy is the legal justification for abortion according to Roe versus Wade. So oftentimes you'll hear it this way. Abortion is an issue of privacy. It is an issue between a woman and her doctor. It is an issue between a woman and her, you know, quotation marks, small g, God, because of the kind of culture we live in. And so oftentimes I'm told, well, you need to get out of this issue. Well, I'm not going to get upset, and I'm not going to jump on the defensive. I'm going to do very much like Greg's tactics, because this is a tactic. I'm going to hold my hand out about waist high as a visual aid, and I'm going to say, I have a three-year-old standing next to me. His mom would like the right to beat him up and kill him in the privacy of her bedroom at home. Should she have the right to do that? Now, the other person's going to look at me like I'm a little bit crazy, and they're going to say, no, you're crazy. But I'm going to ask them another question, because I'm trying to get to a point here. I'm going to say, why not? And as soon as I say that, they're going to answer with something like, well, that child is obviously a human being, to which I will respond, ah, see, that's what I want to talk about, is the unborn human like that 3-year-old. Let's talk about that. See how I've brought it back to the question. Same thing can be done with a number of things. Poverty. Think about the, or you shouldn't push your morality in other people. You think of a toddler. And you use that technique, hold your hand out, and bring it back to that question. Is the unborn human like that toddler? Oh, once you've done that, I'm just going to keep the ball rolling here. Once you've done that, you've gotten back to the question, then you got to answer the question. You can't just leave them hanging. Now, oftentimes the mistake that I find is that people will accuse me when I'm making a case for my pro-life view of appealing to my religion.
Or
say something along the lines of, oh, I see you must be a religious person, or, oh, you must be a Christian, and so you're pro-life. I get that. That's nice for you. I think differently. That happens a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the problem with that is it's a categorical error, because the kind of question I'm asking is not a religious question. It's a scientific one. And so I go to science. I don't go to my Bible to find out what the unborn is. I go to science.
Yeah.
In this case, I go to the science of embryology, and what that science tells us is that from the earliest stages of development, and that would be conception, the unborn is a living, distinct, and whole human being.
Mm-hmm.
And you can flesh out each one of those. We know that it's alive scientifically. The unborn undergoes cellular reproduction, for example. That means it grows. The unborn metabolizes food into energy. The unborn responds to stimuli. All of these are scientific definitions of something that is alive. It's distinct in that it has its own unique genetic code, and a code that differs from mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the unborn is whole, because unlike my bodily cells, my somatic cells, my skin cells, for example, that I could scratch off the back of my hand and send them hurtling to their deaths on the floor. Those are a part of me. We know that because those cells contribute to the overall function of me, of the organism that is me. The embryo is different in kind from those cells. It's even different in kind from sperm and egg. Both of those are also part of a larger organism. But the embryo is a whole in and of itself scientifically. And its cells work together to contribute to its overall function. So that's the scientific answer of something that is, of what the unborn is. It's a human being, without question.
There is a whole lot to comment on. To try and go back to the beginning with all these reasons a woman can have to have an abortion, something I've tried to say in my pro-life projects when I go out and argue this is that, by and large, the reasons women choose to have abortion, their goals that they have in mind for that, we would by and large say those are good goals. I mean, a woman who says, for instance, I need financial security. Well, we don't condemn financial security. Or I want to have a career. I'm not stopping you from that one. Or I'm not ready to be a parent. Well, you can always do adoption and such. So the motivation isn't really the problem. It's the action. That's the problem.
Right. Right. The how you're choosing to get there. Right. And that's funny because, you know, oftentimes the terms pro-life and pro-choice can be misleading. For example, I am all the way pro-choice when it comes to these types of things you're naming. I think women should be allowed to choose their own husbands, their own careers, what cars drive, where they would like to live, any number of things. But you're right, Nick. There are some choices that are morally wrong.
Yeah.
In this case, abortion is one of those choices.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also made a statement about living cells, and I thought that was extremely important. I remember someone once telling me, in fact, that same thing. Like, yeah, I can scratch skin off my arm there, and yeah, those are living human cells, and they're dying. And then you also said it's different from the sperm and the egg, because I think even Carl Sagan said when someone made the argument about sperm being living, and it's saying, well, does that mean masturbation is mass murder then, for instance? So,
right.
How exactly is the embryo different from all these other cells?
Well, I pointed out a little bit, but I'll go a little more in depth. Those cells do contain all of your DNA encoding. They are alive. But as I pointed out, scientifically, those cells are a part of a larger organism, and that is you. They contribute to the organism's overall function. So we call that the difference between part versus whole. The embryo is a whole entity in and of itself. It is different in kind in that way from a skin cell or the stuff we're made of, the somatic cells. I can point out another difference that might be helpful, Nick. Philosopher Richard Stith has given us a wonderful illustration to understand the difference between what he calls construction and development. I think oftentimes we tend to think about the unborn as things that are constructed. I have a 7-year-old daughter, and she, from time to time, loves to play with Legos, which I'm grateful for because I like Legos too, so that's something I can do with her down at the floor. So she'll tell me, Mommy, I'm going to build a Lego castle. And I'll say, great, honey, you go right ahead. Well, she works for a little while and comes up with something that resembles a Lego castle, I guess, or in her eyes it does. But when she puts those first two Legos together, she doesn't have a Lego castle. At that point, it could be anything. It could be a Lego animal or a Lego monster or whatever. That's the beauty of Legos. At what point in that process does her castle appear? Well, it's the end product, and it's the sum of its parts. It's a constructed thing. The embryo is different. People think about it as, that's why we hear, oh, it's a clump of cells. It's just a clump of cells, and I think people often think that the embryos or babies are constructed like Legos are, that you have a clump of cells and then you add some more. And then you add some arms and a leg somewhere along the way, a head, and the end product is a baby. But at this point, what Richard Smith says is that the unborn does something that no constructed thing could do, and that is it develops itself from within. We didn't, and Scott says this all the time, we didn't come from embryos. We once were embryos. And we drove our own development from that very beginning point.
Yeah, and one way you could probably look at this also is, for instance, when you scratch those skin cells off, they're gone. But suppose you could just take them and isolate them and put them in a lab. And on the other hand, my wife and I, you could take, for instance, my sperm and one of her eggs, and you could just leave them by themselves along with the skin cell. All you want is just leave them for all eternity. They can sit there. They will never have a chance of becoming another human being or developing into one. But if you put that sperm and egg together, things change at that point.
Exactly. And given, in the case of something like in vitro fertilization, that electric current begins that process that would begin inside the mother's womb. But yes, development begins.
Something happens. Now, you have made statements about embryology and such. I do think that in the past, that question was difficult to answer because we didn't have clear definition of when human life began. Would you say that's true?
I think that maybe at some point that was the case, but more because women had no ability to know that they were pregnant until a certain point. I think that's why some of the earlier arguments would say, oh, well, quickening is when life begins, because that was when the woman felt movement for the first time. They didn't have the medical technology to see what was going on in there.
Okay, but we do have that technology today.
Absolutely.
Okay, so tell us what this technology has revealed exactly in. Who are is saying this? Is it just Christian scientists, or is it scientists in general? And is it, if it's any scientists, are these just the hack scientists on the side who are crazy, or are these the great authorities in their field?
Oh, no. These are science, or at least revered scientists, and not all of them Christian. But this is what science has told us since that science developed, since we had that ability to look and see, wow, this is what's going on. So you can pick up an embryology textbook. I know Moore and Perseus, The Developing Human, is one that's very commonly used. And look inside of there and see. It explains the entire process scientifically. So is that answering the question? So what that did reveal is that life actually does begin at conception. And so the argument over is it human or not, is it alive or not, science has never squabbled about that. Mm-hmm. And even the most, I guess, a lot of the pro-choicers in academia, they don't squabble about that. Mm-hmm. They say, oh, it's human. You know, the difference lies, they'll go to philosophy to point out some other differences, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yeah.
But no,
I think
sound.
Go on.
That's it. I was just saying the science is sound, and it's not being argued over.
I think even Peter Singer has said that we in a pro-life camp are certainly right about one thing. There is nothing magical about the birth canal.
Right.
So this information, was it available back in 1973?
Well, scientifically, was it available? I've got a yes. The science knew what was going on. The difference became more matters of philosophy. Well, and the funny thing was, let me go back. In Roe versus Wade, Justice Blackmun, who actually wrote the opinion, made the statement, "We don't know when life begins," which is, you know, is interesting. Even if that were the case, if we don't know when life begins, then it would make sense to err on the side of caution. And in saying that, you think of a building being about to be demolished. If there were the slightest chance that there were a human being inside of that building, I think you'd hold back the wrecking ball and go and check and see. The interesting point is that he said that, but then he actually did say, he did claim to know when life began, or the court did, when they said that birth would be the point at which you couldn't go, you know, that's the stopping point. That's when abortion is no longer allowed, is when the child is born.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead.
Yeah, I think the analogy I've heard of that also is if you're out hunting with your buddies and you're trying to shoot a prize buck, if you see something moving and you're not sure if it's your buddy or the buck, you're not going to take a shot.
That's right.
Yeah, I also understand that a lot of pro-life organizations refer to a congressional hearing even that took place on the question of when life began. And there were several geneticists and embryologists and such who came and testified, yes, there's no question. Life begins at conception.
Right. Yeah, that's the science is sound.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we go to science when we're answering that question, what is the unborn? We live in a culture that trusts science. And sometimes they may, you know, may trust it a little bit too much when it becomes a worldview type of, or a religion even.
Scientism.
Yeah, and so what we spend a lot of time doing is teaching people how to point that out. Because like I said earlier, the ideas that are out there have become so convoluted that on the street level especially, you'll hear that a lot of times. Well, it's not even human. So I think it's our job to very gently and graciously point out, well, actually, it is without question, and this is not a religious question.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can go to the textbook and read and see.
Mm-hmm. Why is it then you think that if our culture is so constantly wanting to say, let's see what science says, let's see what science says over and over, that on this one area, they don't seem to be doing that?
Right. Yeah. By and large, you know, generally speaking,
I mean, the greatest advocates of abortion and such out there, they're not really challenging the science that's being put forward by the pro-life position. That's coming on other areas, isn't it? That the challenge is coming to, isn't it?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. They go and they begin to answer that second question I pointed out earlier, which is, why are human beings valuable? So they'll start to make distinctions between humans and persons. Things like that. So what they're really getting at is, we don't argue over the science. And that sometimes it can get a little tricky, which is why we go on and we teach students how to make the philosophic case for human value, because that's where you've got to go. So people will say, we don't argue over the science. Sure, it's a human, but it's not a person. And by that, what they're getting at is it's not a human being who is valuable and deserving of rights. So that leads you, like I say, right into philosophy where you've got to start.
Okay.
Your argument there, yes.
All right. Well, I also understand there's a sled argument. So before we get that, I'd like to discuss the sled argument, but let's do that after this break. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters podcast, and we will be back after this brief break.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com. Hey, this is Minister Grok. Thanks for listening. Although Grok Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at CYIWorldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters podcast. I'm back with my guest, Megan Allman of the Life Training Institute. Our number is 714-242-5180. Now, I understand another basic case that can be made is a famous one that's called the sled argument.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us what the sled argument is?
I can. Let me lead into that just a little bit. The sled argument is one where we're answering that question about human value. And to answer that question, we have to go and to philosophy. And there are really only two kinds of answers someone can give for the question, why are human beings valuable? One of those answers is that human beings have instrumental value. Think of an instrument. You use it for a purpose. So instrumental value is going to name a trait or an attribute that someone has. When someone makes a call and says human beings are valuable because of some arbitrary trait, they are saying that human beings are merely carriers of what is valuable. Peter Singer would be a prime example. We could talk about him in a moment if you want to. Now, the other type of answer that you can give to that question is that human beings are intrinsically valuable, and that is they are valuable in light of the kind of thing they are. In other words, your value lies in your human nature and nowhere else. So just because you're human, you're valuable. Now, what Sled tries to point out is that philosophically, intrinsic value is the only reasonable answer you can give, because any other type of answer runs into problems. Stephen Schwartz actually told us that there is no morally relevant difference between the embryo that we once were and the adults that we are today that would justify killing us at that earlier stage of development. And what Schwartz goes on to say, and Scott has since modified this, and it is Sled, is that the only differences that abortion advocates can point out between the unborn and us lie in four categories, and those are size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. That's the Sled. And you just flesh that out a little bit more. Think about something like size. The argument would go, the embryo is tiny, therefore it's not valuable. Well, if that's true, then we run into some problems, because it creates this spectrum. We are all different sizes. In fact, women in general are smaller than their male counterparts. And so if we hold that size value is grounded, that would mean that women at large are less valuable than men. Less deserving of a right to life. And you can go a million ways with that. You can compare Shawn Johnson, the Olympic gold medalist in gymnastics, to Shaquille O'Neal. And she just doesn't stand a chance. Neither do I. You know, when Shaq walks into a room, he is just the most valuable on that view. So there's just a problem with it. Philosophy dictates. Level of development would be another. the unborn are less developed than we are, so they don't deserve a right to life. Well, you know, my daughter doesn't yet have a fully working reproductive system. She is not as developed as I am, as her mom, and but I can't kill her. I can't take her life because of that. Environment is another one. But the question is, as Francis Beckwith points out, does where you are have any bearing on what you are? In other words, do you roll over at night and become someone different? And the answer is no. So philosophically, how does an 8 to 10 inch journey down the birth canal change a non-valuable, non-human entity into a valuable human entity? You just run into problems there. The last one, degree of dependency. The unborn are dependent on their mothers for survival. Well, my mother is diabetic. And diabetics, at least type 1 diabetics, are dependent upon insulin to live. Without it, they'll die. They can't process sugar. And so my mother would be, on that view, less valuable and less deserving of a right to life than I would. But we just, but there's something wrong with that. So your philosophy, again and again, points out you just can't name something like that, name an arbitrary trait without running into some problems.
You spoke about size and never be. I mean, I think it'd be interesting for my audience to hear of it, about the wonder of what takes place in the developmental process. Can you give us kind of like the life of a baby in the womb, all things being equal? And you know what I'm saying?
Can I give it to you? Well, that's scientific. I can definitely point to some wonderful videos and things that you can see that. That show that. I know there was one that came out recently on the Discovery Channel about the development of life in the womb. You can watch it happen. It's amazing. But from, you know, from conception, you have that first division. It goes through these the different phases. You got the blast from there, then it goes through and implants in the mother's womb. And I think it's fun to follow those blogs that are online or those. I know when I was pregnant, each week the blog would send me an update as to what size my baby was, and it would compare it to a piece of fruit. So this would say, oh, this week your baby is the size of a lime. And then, no, this week your baby's the size of an orange. And it would keep going and going. But it was really fun and amazing to follow.
Yeah. We didn't have that technology when my mother was pregnant with me, which was back in 1980. But something I have interesting that I can look back on is my dad took pictures of her regularly, and she'd be holding up a card saying what date it was. So I can look back and look and see, so there's where all the development was taking place and such. So now when you give this a sled argument, what are the objections that you're hearing to it?
Well, when I give sled, I don't hear many objections to it because it's pretty straightforward. Now, what I will hear is people begin to ask me different, well, what about this trait? Well, what about this trait? And still, the problem is they're naming these arbitrary traits, and they do actually fall into those categories. For example, someone will say, well, the unborn at the embryonic stage doesn't look like a human being, to which I have to think to myself, well, what do human beings, what are they supposed to look like at that stage of development? And to point out the difference, just as you would with sled, I think that would be very similar to size because it's talking about physical appearance. You could point out something as simple as people who have been the victims of severe burning or burns, especially to their faces, they don't always appear or look like the rest of us. But we can't kill them based on their appearance. There are other traits that are pointed out. So those are the objections I normally get, is to raise hands and say, well, what about this? Well, what about this? But no one really argues with the straightforward sled because it's pretty evident once you point out those spectrums and what happens when you name something like that.
Yeah, when you start talking about appearance, I started thinking, well, does that mean we could have cured someone like, say, the Elephant Man, for instance?
Exactly.
Or we have huge tumors on them and such. The case that you get does show that it's a human being, then, in that there's a scientific and a philosophical basis for it. So it looks like the trouble we come down to generally is personhood, right?
Right, and that's what we've been talking about with SLED. So what is the difference between a human and a person? And in fact, that's my question when someone brings that up. Well, it's human, but it's not a person. I want to know from them, using calling upon my tactics, which I learned from Greg, you know, what is the difference between a human and a person? And to see what they name. You can use SLED because sometimes it is one of those four very straightforwardly: size, level of development, environment, or degree of dependency. Sometimes it's something a little different, like I just named, physical appearance, for example. And so you can go from there when you're talking with someone.
Mm-hmm. But if they do point to a difference, what is the difference that they usually will give, and what's your response to it?
Oh, Nick, they are, the differences that I've heard are numerous. And we've actually seen throughout history, people have given differences. In Nazi Germany, it was ethnicity. In the United States, up until just a few decades ago, it was race. So in any of those that people start to name, run into problems philosophically. Oftentimes, I will get questions from students about it points to consciousness. Consciousness, and that brings us, it's similar to Peter Singer's argument. So maybe let's talk about Singer for a moment, if you'd like.
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Tell us who Peter Singer is first.
All right. He's a brilliant man. He's a bioethicist at Princeton University. He used to sit on the department chair there. I don't know if he still does. Has written a number of textbooks on bioethics that are used worldwide. One of those is Practical Ethics. I have one on my shelf also called Unsanctifying Human Life. But Singer tells us, just what I said earlier, the unborn is, of course, it's human. No one's ever argued over that. Science tells us that. But, he says, the unborn is not a person. And Singer would define a person as someone who basically is sentient or self-aware, aware of himself and his surroundings, perhaps that he has a future. And so when Singer makes that claim, what he does is he definitely excludes the unborn from valuable personhood. So Singer is a proponent of abortion. He has no problem with it. What it also does, and he is very consistent with his view, because human beings do not become self-aware until around 28 days after birth, give or take, and that's if they're carried full term. Singer would say that up until that point, or perhaps a week after birth, he can't make up his mind about a week or a month, if parents are dissatisfied with the way their newborns have turned out, say if there are physical abnormalities or mental abnormalities, it should be morally permissible for them to discuss with their doctor and that they should have the right to kill their newborn if they choose to do so. Now, once Singer advances the premise that sentience is what grounds personhood or valuable personhood, he excludes other classes of humanity as well. So not only the unborn and newborn, but patients in the late stages of Alzheimer's disease, for example, are not self-aware. The comatose are not self-aware. He's not self-aware when he's sleeping. I don't know if he goes so far as to understand that or not, but I'm sure he has an argument there. So he excludes these human beings from valuable personhood, but Singer would actually grant personhood to some animals who are self-aware. Like I said earlier, ideas have consequences. So on Singer's view, dogs, apes, dolphins, pigs are all valuable persons over and above newborns and the other human beings that I listed. As you can see, there's something a little bit off about that.
To Peter Singer, he would say you're being a speciesist right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, explain to my audience what that means exactly.
That I'm being a speciesist because I believe in human exceptionalism. In other words, I believe that human beings are more valuable than animals. It's not to say I don't believe animals aren't valuable, because I do. I simply believe that human beings are more valuable. And because they're more valuable, have a responsibility to care for those less valuable. I think that animals should be shown great respect. But that would be Singer's view, that I'm a human exceptionalist, I'm a speciesist. Now, the interesting thing about his argument, number one, with reference to the personhood argument, Singer never tells us why self-awareness is what should ground valuable personhood. He just asserts it. So he runs into a problem there philosophically. And with the speciesism argument, Singer is actually guilty of the very thing he's accusing me of being, because the traits that he listed, such as being rational, being self-aware, these types of things, are things that are, I guess, part and parcel with human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he lists those as the most valuable traits. So he himself is being speciesist on that level.
Mm-hmm. If you were asked, though, to explain what makes animal life different from human life, that it's okay to cure an animal under more circumstances than it would be to cure a human being, what would you say?
Mm-hmm. Right, that's a good point. Well, first let me say that, just to point out, the pro-life view does not say that it's never wrong to kill. It says that abortion is wrong because it kills defenseless human beings without proper justification. But when it comes to animals, we look at animals and we see the way that they are in reality. Animals, if they were on par with human value, should be held morally responsible for their actions. We are moral creatures.
Mm-hmm.
So when a killer whale, for example, eats a seal, should we take it to trial for murder and hold it responsible for its actions? That's one of the very basic differences between animals and us. Now, I think animals do they are subsistence kinds of creatures, and they are that to varying degrees. Some maybe certainly are more highly functioning than others. But when it comes down to it, we can look at a case like Michael Vick, for example. Everyone remembers Michael Vick, the Atlanta Falcon, who was arrested for having a dogfighting ring. And the stories were kind of horrific when they found the property and looked at it and the way the dogs were being treated. Now, when it came to that case, the interesting thing is none of the dogs that were killing other dogs went to trial. Vic went to trial, and isn't it because we expected more of him as a man?
Yep.
And held him accountable for the way he was treating the animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so all these things sort of point out that there's just something fundamentally different about human beings than animals.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure whenever you mention Michael Vick, my wife listens to the show here, and whenever we have a chat open, she helps me out in it. But I'm pretty sure her eyes started to sting as soon as you mentioned Michael Vick, because she's a big dog lover, and she can't stand about what he did.
Mm-hmm. But, well, I'm a dog lover, too. I understand.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. So.
But the big thing there being that we just expected more of him as a man. Morally speaking. So he's the one who went to trial, not the dogs, for the acts that they were committing.
Yeah. And to get back to what Singer has said, I remember seeing Jay Bujajewski, I'm sure you've probably heard of him, and he was a...
Tell me the name.
Jay Bujajewski.
Okay.
I'm not familiar,
but go ahead.
Name. He wrote books like How to Stay Christian in College and Line for Heart, Natural Law Theorist. But he said, for instance, that when we look up a claim of you shouldn't kill an innocent human person, pretty much everyone says, yeah, we agree with that. But then you try and redefine one of those or eliminate the group you're wanting to cure from one of those. So you're trying to say, well, the unborn, in this case, for instance, isn't a person, and therefore they might be innocent, they might be human, but they're not persons, therefore it's okay to kill them. And I think Francis Beckwith has even taken the same kind of approach.
Mm-hmm. Just to show the difference?
Yeah.
To show that that's an arbitrary difference, it's not something that holds water.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and take our next break, then we'll come back and we'll discuss some more of the objections that we received to this position. Our number is 714-242-5180. We would love to have you call in. Our guest is Megan Allman of the Life Training Institute.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you Grok?
Hey, this is Minister Grok. Thanks for listening. Although Grok Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at CYIWorldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
We are back with Megan Allman of the Life Training Institute. Our number is 714-242-5180. I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters podcast. I'd like to discuss some objections that are given to those of us on the pro-life side. And I'd like to start this one with a literal scenario, and I'm sure, Megan, you are going to recognize it immediately. But supposing one day you wake up in a hotel room, and you're not sure how you got there, and lo and behold, you realize that attached to you and hooked up with all these cords and wires is a violinist. Mm-hmm. And you find out you've been kidnapped by a music lovers association, and your body is being used to sustain a violinist. And he needs to be connected to you entirely for 9 months. Now, once that time is done, he's free to go, and he'll never bother you again. But if you disconnect that time, the violinist would die. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know that argument very well.
Yes, the violinist argument.
Mm-hmm. Judith Jarvis Thompson came up with that one years ago. I understand that that even a lot of pro-lifers were stunned when that argument came out, because it really is a very powerful argument with rhetoric. But does the argument really hold up?
That's a great question. It does seem to have some teeth right when you hear it. It sounds a little bit intimidating because, and the very reason is because it concedes the scientific view, of course, and even it seems to concede that the unborn are valuable person. But draws the autonomy card. It doesn't matter, Thompson says, because I, my body, my rights. My rights trump the unborn's rights. And that's the argument that she's making. And Thompson was an MIT scholar. I think that essay came from around 1971 or so. So actually prior to Roe v. Wade. Well, what happens when something like that comes up, Nick, is that you have to look at the story that Thompson is telling and the parallels that she is making with a woman who has become pregnant. And what happens when that kind of argument is, if the parallels do not hold up, the argument falls. Mm-hmm. Now, there are several parallels that can be pointed out between the story that you just told about the violinist and a pregnant woman. Number one, and I'm just going to name a few, if that's all right with you, the responsibility for pregnancy, being a natural result of sex, that is being pitted up and against, in Thompson's view, being kidnapped and plugged up to someone, having the tubes connected to you. So that's the first parallel that's happening. And that responsibility for pregnancy, this is barring, of course, cases of rape, which can be talked about differently. But that parallel seems to be, there's something wrong with it. Mm-hmm. You know, it is this idea that you can have, that you consented to the sex, but not to the resulting pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Does that really hold up, and is it the same as being kidnapped and plugged up to someone? The second parallel you can point out is Thompson is comparing pregnancy to a prison bed, as if you're just imprisoned by your condition. But as we know scientifically, the woman's body is designed to handle such a thing and handle it very well most of the time. Now, withholding the third parallel I'm going to point out is that in the case of the violinist, what we have here is the question of withholding support. Should you be allowed to disconnect yourself from this violinist? Well, here, the problem is there's a difference between withholding support and intentionally killing something. And so that parallel falls. That's a pretty big difference. And I think the kicker to this one is that Judith Jarvis Thompson wants us to believe that a mother has no more duty to her own child as she does to a perfect stranger, and even a kidnapper, you know, in this case, or I guess the music lover's kidnapped. But there's something that we can look at that and think, that just sounds wrong. So even in those parallels, to point them out, the argument doesn't seem to stand.
Yeah, some of that I understand from my years of studying philosophy was that when you're looking at an argument or looking at two things, you don't really want to look at how they're the same so much. You want to see how they're different. And the differences, in this case, very kill the argument. You've said something else of interest about how the woman's design for this kind of thing, that this is kind of like what she does, her body is built that way. And this kind of gets me into some other objections, because I think it'd be important for us to discuss the man on the street objections, is that I think it's so great that I've got a woman here talking about this, because one of the objections that a man can get is, you're not a woman, you don't have a uterus, you don't know what it's like. What do you think of that kind of argument?
Well, it's not really an argument. This is no more, and I think I'm going to quote Christopher Kaiser here, or paraphrase him, this is no more a woman's argument than it would be someone who has brown eyes. In other words, the ideas stand. The facts stand scientifically and philosophically. So whether it's a woman making a case or a man making a case, it doesn't matter. Because what's being discussed here is the morality, the rightness or wrongness of the act. Now, I think what they're trying to maybe tug on there is some of the psychological complexity that can be associated with these types of issues. But I don't think that pro-lifers deny that that abortion can at times be psychologically complex. So sometimes it's important to make that distinction.
In fact, Francis Beckwith, in his book Defending Life, even said, if it's the case that men's opinions don't matter, well, let's go with that, because Roe v. Wade was decided by 9 men.
That's right.
Yeah, you just said something about the woman's feelings and such. I think Scott Klusendorf, interestingly, said the other day that it's not a good case, though. And I'm not saying you're making the case. In fact, I think you're going against making this case, that we shouldn't make the case for life dependent on the woman's feelings, because a woman could feel really guilty after having an abortion, or she could feel just fine and have no guilt whatsoever.
Right. That's a good point, Nick. I think that sometimes when there are those out there making a case for the pro-life view, testimonies are wonderful and powerful things. I think they're most powerful when they are accompanied by these types of arguments. So you have both the facts and the experiential thing. But what we have to remember is that there's always a testimony from the other side.
Yeah.
So to match feelings with feelings, just like you said, sometimes the outcome or the feelings are very positive, and I don't think that that's grounded in understanding what actually took place with the abortion, but yes, that is the case sometimes. So we have to go to the apologetic. It's why what we do at LTI, I think, is so important.
I have a friend who's a woman, and I recently heard her on another program telling her story with abortion in the past and such, that she'd had some abortions, and she warned against this idea of appealing to a person's feelings. She said, go out there and give them the facts, because women can be rational and women can handle the facts.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing she'd said is that she tells people regularly, says that they say they're not ready to be a mother. And she says, she always tells them, you already are a mother. The question is, are you going to be a mother of a living baby or a dead baby?
That's an excellent point. Wow.
Okay. Now, when we get to some of these other objections, like, let's look at something else you said. You said that sex, for instance, is generally a consensual act, despite, in contrast to what Judith Jarvis Thompson said about being kidnapped and such. Mm-hmm. So someone could say, well, okay, what about rape or incest? Yeah. Those aren't consensual acts. What do you do with those?
Yeah, that's a good question, Nick. I get that question a lot from students. Mm-hmm. When it comes to that question, I feel like you have to answer it in a couple of different ways, and it's important that you answer it in both of these ways. I think most of the time when it comes to issues with rape, and keep in mind, you know, we're talking about this very academically on the show today, so I want people to understand that let me just go ahead. What I normally do with students is I want them to know how I feel about it. Mm-hmm. I want them to know exactly how the fact that rape even exists makes me feel. I will tell them that it truthfully, it does. It makes me sick to my very core. It makes me angry. I feel it's like a kick in the gut to see stories about these types of things on the evening news.
Yeah.
So I feel very strongly about these types of things. And I think God feels that way. And rightfully so. Now, when it comes to speaking to someone who's been through something like that, Nick, I can't even begin to address what they must be going through psychologically. I've never been raped.
Thank God.
It's important that's stated. I cannot imagine what kind of psychological complex. I just can't. I have no words for it. Now, having said that, and having pointed out, I recognize that it is psychologically very complex, but morally, the question is still very simple. So I think you have to come up front with that, and you have to answer something like that, so that you recognize. Most of the time, people's objection to this one is emotional rather than intellectual. But morally, I can go right back to trotting out the toddler, and I can hold my hand up to the side and say, I have a 3-year-old standing here. He was conceived through rape, and he reminds his mom every day of that very traumatic experience. Can she kill her toddler? Or you know, a different kind of question. In a civil society, how do we treat other people who remind us of horrible things? Can we kill them in order to make ourselves feel better? You know, that's the question. So morally, it still comes back to that, and I don't think abortion is justified. Now, I think it's important to point out, especially with the students I work with, again, because they're struggling with this one emotionally. I want them to understand, I don't always like that answer. If someone is standing in front of me and has been through something like that, my sympathy is right there with her in this case, because she's right here. I can see her. I can feel her pain. But it takes tremendous courage to continue to stand on what is true in this situation. I think it's what we have to do still. And there's nothing easy about it at times.
Well, you know, Megan, I also know some people who could come and say, well, if you're willing to do something to get rid of abortion, we're just going to have women go back to back alley abortions with coat hangers, and we'll have the 7,500 to 10,000 deaths that took place again. And is that what you want to see happen?
Right. I've heard that one. That one kind of comes out in heated ways at times. The problem with that kind of view is that this idea, well, we shouldn't make something illegal because then it will be dangerous for those who want to go and have it. Well, should we make robbery easier so that armed robbers can have their way? So first of all, philosophically or logically, that argument doesn't make a lot of sense. But even if abortion were to be made illegal, no one is being forced into back alleys. That is that is a personal choice. If someone chooses to go through with something like that, and I certainly hope they wouldn't, that's not the fault of making it illegal. We don't make rape legal so that it's easier for rapists. And I know that's kind of harsh and blunt, but again, we're talking about this intellectually. And furthermore, oftentimes I noticed the numbers that you named, and those were actually more accurate. than those that are often given. Oh, millions died, or hundreds of thousands died, and it's actually a great deal less than that prior to the legalization of abortion.
Yeah, I understand that some people who are testifying in favor, they even knew the statistics weren't accurate, but it was making the case for abortion that really mattered. Now, how about some of these more common objections? Like, I mean, we're not basing our case on the Bible, but there are some people who will say, well, the Bible doesn't say anything about abortion, and Jesus didn't say anything about abortion.
Well, I don't think that silence from the Bible standpoint means permissibility. There are a number of issues, that moral issues that we face today, that the Bible didn't really speak to directly just because of the context in which the Bible was written. But what we can infer from the truth that Scripture does reveal, and that is human beings are intrinsically valuable. It actually backs up the philosophical point I made earlier. That's page one. You know, they're made in the image of God. And we see that taking human life unjustly is absolutely forbidden. So we can infer from Scripture, given what we know scientifically now, that abortion is akin to that it is wrong.
One statement that I've heard from some people who are pro-abortion, and this one just really irks me a lot when I hear it, is that what is in the womb isn't innocent, because it's an invader, it's foreign, it's a parasite to the woman's body. What are your thoughts on that argument?
Yeah, that sounds a lot like Eileen McDonough, who actually took Judith Jarvis Thompson's violinist argument to a different level and compared the unborn child in the case that, like we were saying with Thompson, that you can consent to sex, but you might not consent to the resulting pregnancy that may come from sex. Eileen McDonough says this thing that goes even further to say, or to compare the fetus to a rapist who has invaded the mother's body against her will. Things like that, you don't hear them on the street level very often, first of all, just because there's something strange about that. But when you compare the unborn to a parasite, well, again, we go back to that understanding that biologically a woman's body is designed to sustain child, you know, carrying a child to term and giving birth. And furthermore, where should an unborn child or embryo or fetus be if not in the mother's womb? Where would be the natural place if that's not it? You know, parasite, there's a definition for a parasite, and it does not apply to the unborn.
Well, what about the case, for instance, someone could ask you, what if the woman's life is in danger? I do know there are some people who are pro-life who will say, yes, if both of them are going to die and you have a chance to save a mother's life, then in that case it is morally justifiable. Does LTI have a position on that, or do you have a position, or what can you tell us about that?
I can speak to that one, Nick, and what I'll start by saying is that it's important to point out, if we simply watch television, what we hear from media, what we hear from Hollywood, I'll say that generally speaking, you know, TV shows, we would be led to believe that this is very common, that the mother's life is at risk in a pregnancy. In actuality, it is extremely rare. Medical technology has advanced to the point where it's unbelievably rare when something cannot be done to help a situation, even to the point of chemotherapy can be given now with little to no harm to the unborn child, to the fetus. So that's an interesting thing. Even some numbers here, I'll give you Dr. Thomas Murphy Goodwin, who oversees the largest high-risk pregnancy clinic in the U.S. I think they deliver between 15 and 16,000 children annually. So excluding those cases that are diagnosed late in pregnancy, he says that only one or two cases a year pose an immediate lethal threat to the mother's life. So it's extremely rare. And I want to point that out. I'm still going to answer the question, but that's an important thing to say, I think. I will talk about the case of ectopic pregnancy. An ectopic pregnancy is a pregnancy in which the embryo actually implants in the mother's fallopian tube and does not make it all the way to her uterus where it should implant. Now, as of right now, we don't have the medical technology to relocate that embryo to the mother's uterus where it can develop normally. So what will happen there is, because of space restrictions, that embryo will not be able to fully develop. It won't make it where it is. Now, if allowed to continue developing, what it can do is actually rupture the mother's fallopian tube and cause internal hemorrhaging. And that is a very dangerous situation. And if she doesn't receive medical help immediately, she could very well die. In cases like that, where you are looking at the loss of two lives, the embryo and the mother's, I think that when doctors go in ectopic pregnancy to remove the embryo, they are doing the greater moral good there by saving your life. Now, I would not call that an abortion. I wouldn't liken it to abortion. In ethics, we talk about oftentimes the law of double effect. So in this case, the doctor removes the embryo in order to save the mother's life. The unintended side effect is that the embryo will die when that happens. So that's a case, that's a difficult case, where you're looking at the loss of two lives versus saving one. Now, I'm going to go on just a little bit further, Nick, if you don't mind. I just want to speak to this. Even in the case, and there's one of those rare cases where you're looking at a situation, a doctor has to make a call, it's very last minute, it's an emergency. Let me give an illustration. If I had a room full of people sitting in front of me, and the room inexplicably burst into flames, and people were glued to their seats, let's say I had to grab a couple and get out as fast as I could, and I could only grab two in the front row, and the rest were left, and they perished in the fire. Would it make those who were left behind any less human and any less valuable because I chose the two in the front? So do you see what I'm getting at there?
Yeah.
I think those situations are simply a tragic situation where a difficult decision has to be made. I don't think for our cases that it demotes the humanity or the value of either one.
Okay. Well, we're going to take another break, and then we'll be back. And since you mentioned crisis pregnancy centers, let's talk about what we can do for women who are struggling. So we'll be back in a little bit for the Deeper Waters podcast.
Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grock as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told. Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
I can't believe in you today. Oh, I can't close my eyes and make it go.
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters podcast. We're talking with Megan Allman of the Life Training Institute. The call-in number is 714-242-5180. Now, we've started talking a little bit about crisis pregnancy centers. Let's suppose there is a woman out there who is considering abortion. Let's take this hypothetical woman who's out here listening to this program right now, and she's considering an abortion. What are your words to her?
Intellectually, she's been listening, then she's heard the scientific case I've made and the philosophic case I've made for human life, that the unborn is unquestionably human, that the unborn is unquestionably valuable, just like we are. So intellectually, the question has been answered. But what I would want to say in light of crisis pregnancy centers is she is not alone, and there are those out there who are willing, not only willing, but who desire to come alongside of her and to walk with her through what she has ahead. She does not have to face a pregnancy alone. And there are situations that are unbelievably difficult out there. Nick, like I said, the psychological complexity can be overwhelming. But there are places to go, and there are people who want her there, and they want to help her, and they want to love her in active ways as far as supplying her with what she might need, and including emotional support.
Tell us about some of these institutions that are available. If a woman's wanting to find a place like this, what can she do?
Well, many communities have, they usually are called crisis pregnancy centers. Sometimes they are called hope centers. You know, there are different ones around. So I'm sure if you did a simple computer search for one in your area, you could find one. Of course, if that's not the case, then go to a local church, because many of the churches are connected with the crisis pregnancy centers and know how to get in touch with someone who can help. And if they don't have one in the community, then being church, you know, I certainly would hope they would be willing to step in and help out in any way they could. So that's how you can locate them.
Now, in the description for this episode, I've called abortion the modern-day Holocaust. So this is kind of a two-part. First thing is, I'm wondering if you would agree with that. And secondly, since abortion's a problem anyway, let's suppose we take the average Christian who's saying, hey, I understand the situation's serious, but I'm not very sure what I can do to help out.
Number one, Nick, I do agree with you in terms of these days, increasingly, abortion has become a way in which we, as a culture, are saying these human beings do not deserve to live for whatever reason may be given, and so they are being snuffed out. You know, whether or not the idea, I'm very careful not to use words usually like murder. I think murder implies intent, ethically speaking, and I think, like I have referred to a couple of times, that sometimes the ideas are so mixed up, people may not know the truth of what is actually happening. But in terms of what I said about singling some human beings out as being less important than others, and even so much so that they are deserving of death, yes, in that way, it is akin to the Holocaust. As Christians, just as Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a great voice of reason and truth during the time of Nazi Germany and was actually killed for his efforts to rally the churches, I think that we can learn a lot from the things that he said and did. And for the churches to remain silent is for them, in a way, to contribute to the evil that's going on. For individuals to do nothing is allowing it to continue. So it is taking a stand. And so I would just encourage Christians. There are resources out there like you, Nick. There are resources like Life Training Institute. Seek them out. Equip yourself and be a voice for reason in the community.
Well, some of us could think that it's very difficult when political spheres start getting entered into and such. So how can we tread this fine line if we might want to say, well, we don't want to get involved in politics. So what do we do exactly?
Well, that is, well, we are not a political organization, so we'll preface it by saying that. But as a Christian, that's an unusual kind of statement for me. If the Christian worldview is really true, and I think that it is. In fact, I think that's the only reason you could believe anything, is if it's absolutely true and you believe that. If it is, it encompasses all realms of our lives, and that certainly includes those whom we, and because we have the ability in our nation, at least right now, to vote someone to be the authority over us, to be in that position, we have a say. We should use it well. We have these certain freedoms that we've been given to speak out and to in a sense, have an effect on the sway of things when it comes to politics, as it were. I don't think we should stay out of it or use an excuse like that to stay out of it. Now, I can understand, you know, those conversations can at times be uncomfortable, but I think that they are not so very different from what we've been talking about during this entire show.
Yeah.
I think that it's the same thing. You make your case for life, and you do so winsomely and graciously, and you offer the truth and love, because Jesus certainly was both truth and love.
I've been told a lot that the pro-life movement today, by and large, It's a youth movement. Young people are the ones who are most standing up on the pro-life bandwagon. Would you say that's correct?
Right now, in fact, Scott speaks in many churches, as we all do, but he has had several speaking engagements recently, and he throws a challenge out to those in the church to let them know that they have young leaders who are up and coming because of groups like Students for Life of America, I'm thinking the Justice for All, and different groups like that are very involved, especially on college campuses. There are young people who are being equipped and who are hungry to go out and change the tide of the culture. And so the challenge for the older generation is, are you ready for them? Because here they come. They're here. Mm-hmm. They want someone who's going to mentor them, who's going to speak to them, who's going to give them a platform. And and are you ready?
Yeah.
It's not get ready.
Now, this generation that's coming up that really is gung-ho on the pro-life movement, do you think that if they really put forward their efforts and they did the hard work that's needed, we could overturn Roe v. Wade?
I hope so.
Mm-hmm.
I hope so. And I am an optimist. And even if I wasn't, my duty is to speak for those who cannot speak for themselves.
Yeah.
As a human being, as a Christian, that is what I have to do. Now, the real goal, I think, that's gonna accomplish that is not. Perhaps it will come about through change in legislation, and I certainly hope that that is the case. I think that on some level, before that can happen, the culture has to be one. It may happen the other way. If so, I will be right on board with it and still doing what I'm doing. But I think the culture has to be won over. And right now it's with ideas. These young people who are so hungry, what they're hungry for are, give me reasons. I want to know why. Why is the pro-life view more rational? Why is it more important? Why does it matter to me? And they're getting that more and more. So I hope that influence will begin to win over campuses across the nation, churches across the nation, high schools across the nation, the up-and-coming generation. Yes, I hope so, in short.
Now, we talked a little bit at the start of this segment about the woman who's thinking about having an abortion. So let's go the other end. Let's suppose you got a woman who's been listening out here now, and she's had an abortion. And right now, I mean, we're not appealing to feelings. Let's suppose feelings are there, and she's got a conviction based on what she's heard, and she's wondering, is there forgiveness? Is there grace out there for me? What is your message to her?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, Nick. I do not take my job lightly, and I don't travel all around the nation in order to condemn people, in order to make them feel guilty and to just drive that in further. I don't do that. And in fact, I can't condemn anyone. And the reason I can't condemn anyone is just as I think that this is an objective type of issue. I think that Christianity is absolutely true. And what it tells me is that God created the world, and he created it good, and he created it wonderful, and he created human beings to live and to love him and to worship him forever. And humankind rebelled, and they chose to put themselves in God's place. And see, when that happened, the playing field was leveled. It does not matter who you are or what you've done or what you haven't done. God could have destroyed every last one of us, and he would still be good and still be just, if he chose to do so. That's the hard truth of Christianity. But he didn't choose to do that. He chose to send his son, the infinite, the second person of the Trinity, became a single-celled zygote in Mary's womb for us. He limited himself that much, and he lived a life that we could never live. And he accomplished righteousness that we could not. And he took on himself every last bit of the punishment that was due you and me. That's the gospel. And so when it comes to those who've been touched by this issue, even if it's indirectly, they need the same thing that everyone of us needs. And that is, as Scott would have often said, an exchange instead of an excuse. Christ's righteousness for our unrighteousness. That is there and it's available, and I believe it's absolutely true. And because I believe it's true, mm-hmm. I talk about this issue, and because I think that's the only place you can find real healing and real hope.
Mm-hmm. And how should the church then be when women come in and they've said, I've had an abortion?
Mm-hmm. I think that in those situations, just as in any situation, because the church is full of sinners. Mm-hmm. That's what makes up the church. Mm-hmm. In that situation, take a note from Jesus himself. When the adulterous woman was there and the Pharisees stood around ready to stone her for her action, mm-hmm. and Jesus said, let he who is without sin cast the first stone, mm-hmm. knowing full well that he was the only one in that situation who could have.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he took her by the hand and he stood her up and told her, go and sin no more. And I think that's where his grace speaks volumes to a culture that is hurting.
Mm-hmm.
It's hurting really badly because of this issue.
Mm-hmm. We've mentioned what would be said of a woman, but I refer to a friend who I heard her give her testimony about this matter around a month or so ago, and she said one of the mistakes that we can make is this isn't just a woman's issue. A lot of men have issues with abortion. Some men might have been responsible in pushing a woman to get an abortion, or maybe not stopping a woman from getting an abortion. So
mm-hmm.
what would you say to the men who are struggling as well?
I would certainly say that the same thing is true. The gospel is universal. It applies
mm-hmm.
to every last of us. It is freely given to me, just as it's freely given to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I can't preach this message about human value for the unborn without recognizing mm-hmm. the full value of
mm-hmm.
anyone who's standing in front of me. And mm-hmm. that would certainly apply to those. So yes, gosh, forgiveness, healing is there. It's
mm-hmm.
there, and I guess my heart just goes out.
Yeah.
My heart goes out to them, and I hope that these words reach those who are struggling.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Life Training Institute, I'm sure, has several great resources that can be used in this. So before we go to our final segment, can you tell us
mm-hmm.
a bit more about how we can get resources from the Life Training Institute and what kind of resources they are, and maybe even if someone wants someone from LTI to come speak at their church or Christian organization, what do they do?
Absolutely. Well, Life Training Institute, our website is www.prolifetraining, spelled out in no spaces, prolifetraining.com. And at our website, what you can find are a multitude of articles. We have a blog that we keep updated with current events and different things that are going on and training materials. We have media, such as video and audio, that you can go through and watch our presentations. Quick newsletters that you can read over, ones even titled How to Defend Your Pro-Life Views in 5 Minutes or Less. And so that's a great resource to look at. Those are all there. Scott has written or co-written a couple of different books. One is called The Case for Life, and
mm-hmm.
there certainly you can find how to purchase that book at Life Training Institute. Everything that I went over about how to make your case for your pro-life view, in fact, everything that we have talked about today, save the most current events, are in that book. And
mm-hmm.
there you can be equipped to handle those types of arguments. His latest book is called Stand for Life. It was co-written with John Enzer. And that is a student's guide for making their case for life,
mm-hmm.
although I would say very accessible and not just for students. I very much enjoyed reading that one as well. So those resources are all there. To get in touch with us, of course, our contact information is at that website, www.prolifetraining.com. And we are here. We're here for you. We're on Facebook and love to answer questions by email or by phone, or, of course, speaking is our, that's what we do.
Well, we're going to be back for our last segment soon, and we'll be talking about abortion and the disabled in that segment. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You could send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
This is Mike Licona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
And we are back to this podcast here. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. I'd like to remind everyone before we start discussing the matters here that this is a listener-supported ministry, just like Life Training Institute is supported by its fans and friends. And so we need your support. For myself personally, you can go to deeperwaters.wordpress.com and you can find out how you can donate from there. We have a Facebook page. You can subscribe to our newsletter or you can like us. And I encourage you to do all of it. And if you're listening here next week, we will have Nabil Qureshi on, and we will be talking about Islam. And he is a former Muslim. It should be a very interesting program. But we are talking about abortion with Megan Arman of the Life Training Institute. And one aspect I wanted to talk with her about, and she said she is going to be prepared for it. I have warned in advance specifically on this one, is this is Autism Awareness Month. Now, my wife and I are both Aspies. We're on the spectrum with Asperger's, and it really saddens me when I think this, that there are some people that if they had known that their child could have been on the spectrum like us beforehand, they would have had an abortion. And it's really very saddening when you're on the disabled list to know that there are some people who would just ipso facto think beforehand, you don't really have a right to live. Could you address that some, Megan?
I could, although you're doing a wonderful job. And yes, I'm going to address it a little more academically. And the, give reasons for why that's a problem.
Yeah.
You know, just as we pointed out earlier with the sled argument, philosophically, any time that we say that some human beings are more valuable than others based on an ability, we're going to run into problems philosophically. In the case of some disabilities, it could be physical, it could be cognitive. When we start making those distinctions and saying, oh, more valuable because more cognitively aware, less valuable because less, we run into some real problems. What I want to talk about for just a minute is what we call substance versus properties. It's it's simply the difference in the kinds of things human beings are as opposed to the kinds of things, say, the desk sitting in front of me at the moment is. You know, the desk is a sum of its parts. If I take the desk apart and have all the pieces on the ground, I no longer have a desk. I have a pile of stuff. Human beings are not like that. We are substance kinds of beings. Philosophically, all that means is we have a nature that grounds us through time and change. We are not just the sum of our parts, or we are not just our bodies. That's why, Nick, someone could be in a terrible accident and lose a limb, which would be very tragic. But if that happened, their friends would not be going to the hospital to visit 3/4 of them.
Yeah.
They'd be going to visit their friend.
Yeah.
So even though our bodies can change, our natures do not. And so the types of things you're talking about are, those are basic to every human being's nature.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can't just pick one arbitrarily and say, oh, this is what grounds human value, so I can pick and choose who lives and who dies.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I'm listening to this, you know, I know that there are people on the spectrum who are in far worse positions than Ari and I are. Some of them have a much harder time functioning, but you know, to some women out there, what I tell them is that I'm right now 32. I'll be turning 33 later this year, and you know what? My life is really pretty darn good. I mean, there are some hard times still that we're going through. We have some burdens because of our condition, but I think overall we are blessed. That I don't think a lot of Aspies would get married naturally, and especially not to each other, which makes us a real different case. And what I do with Christian apologetics and such every day, I love it. It is a great joy. I am really happy to be alive. And I look forward to being in the presence of Jesus someday. But I think, yeah, I want to learn as much as I can beforehand. And I want to be around as much as I can for my wife until the time comes when God says, okay, your work's done. Now, I'm sure, though, that in your position, you've probably heard several other accounts like that. And I've noticed, in fact, that women who have children who are severely disabled many times, they can say, those children can be some of the happiest children I ever meet. And I learn so much from those children. Do you have any stories like that?
Of course, I mean, it's hard to just pinpoint one. I have a dear friend of our family who gave birth to a daughter with Down syndrome, and her name is Grace, and her name is very fitting because she has been a vehicle of God's grace to her family, to her parents. So many who have babies like Grace and who grow up and are children, and then now she's a young woman. Talk about that very thing, about what wonder they have brought to their own lives, just to have been in this person's presence. I have another dear friend who, and this sadly is a little more tragic. She gave birth to her son William in December, and Liam was diagnosed. They did not catch it beforehand, so it was a little bit of a strange case. But when he was born, he was diagnosed with the trisomy 13, which is a genetic disorder. It's a rare one. And Liam only lived for around 6 days. But to see the things that Joanna writes now, even just a few months after this happened, she writes things like, my son was loved and held, and now he's in his forever home, and I would not have had it any other way given the circumstances. You know, in other words, had she known beforehand, she would have missed those days with her son, and she wouldn't have it. And was it hard? Unspeakably. But here she is, and what a testimony, and we all miss little Liam. Just many, many stories, Nick, that are like that. And honestly, doing what I do, my understanding as it has grown, I guess you could, as I've been the book nerd, as I've studied intellectually, oh, the substance argument for human persons, and all of these things which are very true, has so affected the way that I see my disabled friends.
Yeah.
And the way that I see myself, because honestly, we are all limited in some capacity. Even if you want to just go theologically and say by sin, we all have limitations.
You know, I had a good friend when I was in Bible college, around my first year or so. That's when I discovered Christian apologetics, and he saw me quoting Ravi Zacharias in a class once, and he thought, this guy could have an interest. And he came to see me afterwards, and he got me further going down the path of apologetics. I went to a seminary he recommended for a time, and so we've remained good friends since then. And it was so bizarre that a couple of years or so ago, he called me, And he said, we just found out our firstborn son has been diagnosed with Asperger's. What do you recommend? It was kind of like an interesting what goes around comes around in some ways.
Oh, wow.
Because he knew I had. He said, okay, what do you say? And he wrote a note later, and he said that, and I'm not saying this to push myself, but he said the best advice he thinks he got was what I told him, because the first thing I told him is, first off, thank God you have been given a blessing right now, because you will get to see the world through a whole new set of eyes that you have never seen it through before, because you have got him and you will have to learn to experience the world the way he experiences it. And that was the main argument. And I really think a lot of women, they are in many ways cheating themselves out of realizing what a blessing they could have. And I'm not going to deny, it's going to be very difficult for many cases, depending on the disability. Some would be much more severe. Some people would be practically bedridden and such. Some won't be as severe and such. But any case, wouldn't it be that a woman who goes on and has the pregnancy and has the child can also experience a great blessing in that child?
I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, to undergird that are, of course, the arguments that we've shown today. Even in these difficult situations that you're talking about, and more extreme ones, you know, abortion is not justified.
Yeah.
It's not. That's a human life. That's a person, an individual who has, and again, back to philosophy, who has those basic or root capacities for everything cognitive that human beings can have, but for some reason isn't able to exercise those capacities to their fullest.
Mm-hmm.
And those are physical reasons. I think this is where Christianity becomes something that is just, of course, it's everything, you know, but where it makes sense of things, because Christianity doesn't deny that these types of things happen in a broken world.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes sense of them, and it offers true hope.
Mm-hmm.
True hope. So I wonder, Nick, one day when you and I are both standing in the presence of Christ, both, you know, unlimited, unlike we are now, what it will be like.
Yeah.
There's such truth in the things that you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when we discuss these kinds of matters, and this isn't just with abortion, with any kind of politics, I mean, the academic side, the intellectual side, it is certainly very, very important. But we do need to remember that there is still a relational side, there's an emotional side, there's a very personal side, because either one of us talking right here, either one of us could have not been here. And I can think back and wonder how many people could there have been in my life that I might have got to know that could have been a blessing, but they were aborted beforehand. And this just reminds us that every single person we meet out there, there is something sacred about that life.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, sacred is, again, it gets us back to that underlying worldview that we've grounded that with arguments today. But just in talking about that for a moment, I think a very challenging question that was posed to me in having to think through some of these very difficult issues was this idea of pitting quality of life against sanctity of life. And you know, there's been a big shift today, and a lot of language refers to, well, what about their quality of life? And the question that was posed to me that stopped me in my tracks, it was very blunt, but it was this: who are you to decide quality of life? That's major. That's a big question.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I'd want to say to someone that I could have been said, who are you to to make the decision that my life isn't worth living. And, you know, with what we're talking about, we had a David Enstone Brewer on here last week. He's a Bible scholar out of the UK. And one thing we talked about was how Christ changed our view of a disabled. And he even changed our view of women as well. And if we want to be Christ to all people, it is imperative that we do all that we can to save the unborn.
I agree. Yes.
And, in fact, with what we were saying the last segment with women who have been struggling with abortion, maybe wondering if they should have it, we have to be Christ to them, definitely, and they encourage them to be Christ to their unborn child. But to the women and the men who have already been complicit in abortions somehow, we have to just as much be Christ to those people.
Yes. Yes, and that's oftentimes, I think pro-lifers are maybe accused, and very unfairly, I think, of only caring about the unborn, not caring about children once they are born, which is blatantly false.
Yeah.
But when a student brings that up to me or asks me about that, because they may have been accused of it in the past while trying to make a case for their views, I do say, you know, well, what are we to do about that, church? That's a question for you guys. What does Scripture have to say to us about how we treat those who are suffering or who find themselves in difficult circumstances? Where are we and what do we do? And you know, the hard thing is that for them especially, and in a culture like ours, back to the very beginning of our talk was instant gratification, you know, a very self-centered culture, generally speaking. The difficult thing to help Christians understand, and gosh, I'm just learning to understand it is our duty. We are called to walk alongside those who are suffering as long as it takes, and there is nothing easy about it, but thank God, literally, that Christianity gives us the message that this time is short and there is a future hope.
We've got about 3 minutes left or so, so it's time we start really wrapping things up here. So let's sum it all up. What is your message out there now to Christians who are listening and saying, I want to do something, I want to help. What do I do exactly?
Right. Well, equip yourself, first of all. Be a voice for life wherever you are. As Greg Kochel would say, bloom where you are planted, be it in your classroom, in your workplace, in your community, on your street, in your church. We have the resources readily available for you. We talked today about what it means to simplify the issue by bringing conversations back to the question, what is the unborn? We talked about how to answer that question by appealing to science. The unborn are living, distinct, and whole human beings. And we talked about how philosophically there's no morally relevant difference between the embryo you once were and the adult you are today. And we used the SLED argument to demonstrate that human value is intrinsic. That means you are valuable just because you're human. All of this is grounded squarely in what Scripture has to say to us in the Christian worldview. So I would just encourage Christians, you know, if you feel that your gifts are to speak, go speak. You can equip yourself with our material and begin speaking in your church, in your school, wherever it might be. Start up a pro-life club, student. Go and do that. Goodness, support organizations like LTI and like Deeper Waters. If that is something that you can do, do it. And together we will change the tide of things. I am hopeful.
Well, next week on our program, I'd like to remind everyone, we are going to be having Nabeel Qureshi come on, and he is going to be talking about Islam. And I'm really looking forward to that one. I think you'll find it's a very fascinating story. But our guest today has been Megan Allman of the Life Training Institute. And I'd really like to thank you for giving us your time today, Megan.
Nick, thank you so much. It has been an absolute honor and privilege.
Thank you. And I hope everyone will be tuning in next week. Until then, I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast, signing off for now.